We've had two FCPA enforcement actions this year. One is involving WPP. What are the key lessons learned from this enforcement action? I posed that question to John Davis and James Tillen, members at Miller and Chevalier, and they explore those questions and many others in this most interesting podcast on the WPP FCPA enforcement action. Are you interested in learning about how design thinking can improve your compliance program? Then check out my latest podcast, Design Thinking and Compliance, where with my co-host, Karsten Tams, we explore this question. Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox back for another episode, and you're in for a treat today because I'm in for a treat today because we're going to have a lot of fun. I have John Davis and James Tillen, members at Miller and Chevalier, and we're going to geek out on the YPP case. So, gentlemen, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be back.
Appreciate you having us.
So this, in many ways, was a fascinating case. Lots going on. Lots going on from the compliance perspective. Lots to unpack. So which one of you guys wants to give us the basic facts?
I can do it. This is John. So basically, WPP is a large advertising agency worldwide. They employed a lot of different people in a lot of different countries around the world. For a period of time in the mid part of this decade, they underwent a very rapid expansion, buying out interests of local advertising firms in what the SEC terms high-risk jurisdictions. So that includes China, India, Brazil, some other places we're going to talk about. And the way that WPP bought these companies, they bought a majority interest, but then left often the founders in place with various types of financial incentives in order to continue to build their network and run each agency as they'd done before. And they did this in a number of places. They did have a central legal and audit function, and technically all of these acquired agencies were supposed to abide by various WPP policies, internal controls, etc. The SEC points out, however, that often that didn't always work in practice. And so what happened at the end of the day is that the SEC order talks about various problems in a couple of different countries, focusing on India and China. Also talks about issues in Brazil and Peru, and we can talk about those in detail.
One of the things that makes this case so delicious is the failure started right off the bat. First of all, I have to say one more time, they had no compliance function, no CCO. So this is a worldwide multi-billion-dollar organization with some 200,000 plus employees with no compliance function. I think that may be the answer. Nevertheless, the failure started in M&A. So I really wanted to ask you guys not only the critical nature of pre-acquisition M&A, but how do you go about doing this when you literally are on a sprint to acquire as many local companies as you can?
I think it is important that you have to embed the compliance due diligence process into the commercial due diligence process. Obviously these companies in expanding rapidly are still considering the benefits that could come from those acquisitions and looking at the dollars and cents associated with that. Well, at the same time that that's happening, the compliance due diligence needs to happen. And then at this, also when planning the integration on the business side, you also plan compliance integration at the same time. And so it really is a key part of acquisition to think about anti-corruption due diligence, anti-corruption compliance integration. And it doesn't need to prevent rapid growth. It just needs to work in parallel with rapid growth at the same pace as the rapid growth to help mitigate risks. And I think this founder, keeping the founders in place with this earn-on provisions is a model that has some risks associated, but that doesn't mean you can't do it. I think, John, maybe you were talking before the call about this very point. It doesn't mean to say that how WPP grew is wrong. It just means that you need to take some precautions if you're going to do it.
I thought this was a great learning example of a compensation strategy that I think we all would agree can be appropriate. And certainly we could even advise our clients on why you need to have an earnout provision. But it can turn high risk. So, John, maybe you could talk about what happens, or how do you rather prevent a compensation strategy that is appropriate from becoming what's called a perverse incentive in compliance, and how do you monitor that on an ongoing basis?
Yeah, it's a good point, and it is a model that can work, and indeed other companies in other sectors, especially in the tech sector, use it a fair amount, and it does allow you to retain the services of founders and other key personnel that you want to keep and that you want to keep incentivized to grow the business. At the same time, I think reading the papers in this case shows that what they didn't do is inculcate with the founder. Well, they didn't do a couple things. As James said, they didn't do really any kind of identifiable risk analysis up front as to what kind of risk they were taking on when they were buying into these companies. What I think that meant was they didn't look very closely at what the founders of these local agencies were doing in terms of their business practices. So they didn't have a good idea going in as to how these businesses were being run, which, of course, is something you really do need to do and dig into from a compliance perspective in order to get your integration right. And it doesn't look like they did that. Secondly, I think they gave the founders a lot of latitude. And again, that can work, but you also have to train these types of folks in terms of what the company's values are, why those incentives are also accompanied by compliance-related incentives, such that you have offsetting or at least complementary types of financial packages that don't perversely, as you say, Tom, drive folks to ignore controls and frankly to commit fraud. Some of these, at least in a couple of these cases, yeah. The ones in India, part of the problem was that the CEO was basically using these types of fraudulent behaviors to take money for himself, and at least in one case to cancel out old balance sheet receivables that he would have probably dragged upon his compensation, and again, it gave him an incentive to come up effectively whole cloth with a fake advertising program that in part was used to bribe officials, according to the SEC, but in part was basically to clean up his own balance sheet. And I think the incentives that he was offered under these earnout provisions drove that. And what you need to do is offset that with training, with related compliance incentives in order to make sure that people stay in control, and then frankly put an accountability structure on top of these types of founders or these types of local or regional leaders in order to make sure that they're doing what they should be.
I was originally going to ask you guys about missed red flags, but the more I thought about it, I wanted to really maybe focus on a broader discussion of a culture of reporting,
yes.
Not simply a whistleblower, because we had some fairly dramatic whistleblowing in this case, that whistleblowing failures at the corporate level, but that led directly to investigative failures. So I was wondering if you might tie those together to help people understand, hey, it's not just having a whistleblower reporting system. It's not just intaking it. It's assessing it at intake. And equally importantly, it's elevating it for an appropriate level of investigation. So could you maybe talk us through how you would counsel a client really for that scope, and so that they understand they are distinct things, but they are much more interrelated than not?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. And it shows that at least in this company, they received a number of whistleblower complaints. So certainly speak up was part of their culture. It was, unfortunately, the investigation part that they seemed to fail. And one of the importance of, you treat investigations like you treat any part of your compliance program. You have to have policies and procedures on it. You need to have a process to, as you said, intake, assess the level and credibility of the allegation, and then have a proportionate response, and also put it in the hands of people that are objective and have the skills and ability to investigate. And what it appears here is that they, for example, in the India situation, gave it to the regional finance person to investigate, not like legal counsel, not. And as you heard, they didn't have a compliance department to look into it. And that regional finance person made some sort of effort by hiring an accounting firm, but that accounting firm didn't have access to the material they needed. They relied on the CFO and CEO of the India entity to provide the materials, who were the people implicated in the wrongdoing, which is exactly the wrong thing to do. You want to try to get at it from a different sources. So having a policy and having a process and having people who are skilled and know what they're doing is incredibly important. And now, and also when to bring in outside resources that have those skills if you can't accomplish what you need to internally. So it's incredibly important to have a robust investigation process that supports that whistleblower reporting line and speak up culture that is the other part of this important aspect of compliance.
Yeah, and one, I agree. And one thing I'll add is, too, structurally, it sounds like WPP wasn't set up the right way. And Tom, you mentioned the lack of the compliance function at the beginning. I think that is critical. You've got to have somebody that's integrating various different reporting chains, because one other thing that was happening here is they were getting internal audit results that should have been sending up red flags in addition to the whistleblower aspects. And there doesn't appear to have been anybody. They had a legal function. They had an internal audit function, but they didn't appear to be talking to each other. And there didn't appear to be anybody in the organization who could put together various of these inputs coming from different places, different speak up provisions and different monitoring mechanisms that were in place to really respond appropriately, either under a policy or otherwise, to what they were seeing. And that led to repeated failures to get on top of what was going on within these various companies in a way that the SEC said, allowed stuff to happen for years.
So let me take it one step further, because I had a colleague named Jim McGrath, who's sadly no longer with us, but about 10 years ago, he started talking about a serious problem begets the need for a serious investigative response. And when someone hires a firm like Miller, part of the reason, I think, is your reputation in dealing with the government on a variety of matters, not simply FCPA. But the other part of hiring a seriously experienced investigative team or law firm investigative team is they know how to do an investigation. And as you said, John, it was pretty clear that whoever this accounting partner at this unnamed accounting firm was, he didn't know how to do an investigation. So I was wondering if you might speak to why it's so important to have experienced investigators who know the basic questions to ask and then can follow the evidence wherever it may go.
Sure. I think, and again, you can have experienced investigators either inside the company or outside the company, and or ideally both. So that's not to suggest that you have to go to someone like us every time. But you certainly want to have folks who are able to exercise independent judgment, who are set up within, if you're inside the company, who are set up within the structure of the company so that they have a level of independence and an ability to push hard for information that they might need without interference by management, that they have a clear set of guidelines as to how they're going about to do things. But it does, in some ways, we've said, it's almost worse to do a bad investigation than no investigation at all. I've told clients that many times. And that, I think, is illustrated by what happened here, is that the company really looks worse because they did something that didn't follow some real basics in terms of independence, in terms of what types of steps that any investigator would probably take in terms of collecting documents and so forth that didn't happen, and it made them look worse. So I think what you want to do, and it does matter in terms of if you're ever going to be looked at by the government in terms of credibility, if you're ever facing your shareholders or other investors, if you're facing banks or auditors, all of them will ask some hard questions. And what it means is a company who's looking at an issue really has to get someone to take a look at the issue, again, can be internal or external, who knows how to run things, how to ask the basic questions, what types of steps that government investigators are going to expect the company to have taken, and what kind of answers that the government, if they're looking at things, are going to expect the company to know when a disclosure is going to be made.
Right. I mean, here it was quite amazing to see that they had access to the emails in the U.S. and that first review they did by the audit firm didn't get to that those emails, which were key given how the CEO and the founder of the India operations controlled those operations, and therefore going to them for the source, you can't rely on it when they were the ones implicated in the wrongdoing. And so it's very difficult to get the information you would need directly from the India subsidiary. So, but to be able to get the emails, that would be a core issue and a core source of data. And the fact that the when they did investigate the correct way, they also used that due diligence firm, which was able to find out the sources on the ground there, what the connections between the official and the CEO. And so finding other sources of data is beyond just going directly to the Indian subsidiary was a significant part of cracking the case open. And so knowing that and knowing where to go is incredibly important. And particularly in these jurisdictions, there's language barriers that might be present. There's different accounting practices. There's different ways of operating a business, and having that local understanding is incredibly important. And so you need all these different skill sets to be able to investigate sufficiently.
We're going to take a break, have a quick message, and we'll be right back with more of James Tillen and John Davis.
Let me turn to an area that may be more in your bailiwick, and that was the China component of this enforcement action. And although the bribery scheme was of some interest, what really intrigued me and I wanted your opinion on was the red flag that was raised because of the result. So typically in an FCPA case, the result is a sale, but there can be a wide variety of other results. And so I was wondering if you might be able to talk to, what did you see in terms of lessons learned that you could talk to clients or counsel clients on about the results you might get when a foreign government official is involved?
Sure. So what happened in China is that the China subsidiary had undertaken various tax avoidance or tax maximization or minimization schemes that were in place, I think, at the time that WPP bought the company, but that continued apace. And indeed, there was an internal audit that WPP can perform that basically identified these tax avoidance issues as or schemes as issues. Unfortunately, nothing was done about it. In the course of that audit as well, there were red flags suggesting that the avoidance schemes, and then subsequently when the Chinese authorities started to audit the Chinese subsidiary themselves and perhaps discover these avoidance schemes, there were clear indicators or red flags of potential payments to officials coming up. And so, for example, there was during the Chinese authorities' audit, the auditors suggested that the company hire a vendor to perform services. And of course, the SEC papers show that the vendor's real purpose was to probably make payments to those officials, although looks like the SEC wasn't able to track those all the way through. But clearly what you had in place here was a tax avoidance scheme that was of questionable legality. I think anybody looking at that, knowing that that existed, could reasonably anticipate that that, especially in a place like China, or frankly in many countries, where you may have the authorities ultimately undertaking an investigation of that, created a bribery risk. And that bribery risk was not recognized even after there were clear red flags with regard to this vendor, with regard to some email communications coming from the CFO to the regional management, where they said basically we're using our personal social connections to manage the audit. We are going to resolve things by getting to gifts and entertainment, things like that, all of which played out. And so in terms of risk areas, as you say, there was not, this is not involving sales, but it was involving a regulatory intervention by the tax authorities that somebody looking at this up front could have identified the fact that the tax avoidance schemes that appeared to be in place here were going to be risks not only of violations of Chinese tax law, but of also bribery risks, because you would have to potentially pay an official to look the other way to let those continue.
Let me now turn to another bribery scheme, and this involved Peru, and perhaps, James, this might be a little more in your bailiwick in Latin America. When I originally read the bribery scheme, I was struck by its sophistication, or at least my perceived sophistication of it, because it was a cross-border bribery scheme, routing monies through another Latin American country, Colombia. But then I wondered, you know, perhaps it was just almost more of just a regional thing where they shared money across national borders. So I wanted to ask you, one, was this a sophisticated mechanism to pay bribes, or do you really need to look at a more of a geo region than simply a country by country analysis?
Well, I think it highlights a risk that John and I have seen in a number of cases where intercompany transactions may not get the same scrutiny as transactions with counterparties outside the business. And so the Peru subsidiary may have taken advantage of controls that were more lax in being able to direct or request related Colombian and Chilean subsidiaries to facilitate payments and got less questions than if they were trying to make a payment to another third party directly. So I think this is something where internal controls or anti-corruption compliance might not necessarily flag right away, but it is a risk, intercompany transactions. And so that's one of the things that jumped out to me. I mean, Peru is a weird one because they were the intermediary. They were paying bribes on behalf of a construction firm instead of on behalf of themselves to this local mayor in Lima. And so it was unusual, but it definitely highlighted this risk that John and I have seen.
The other thing that intrigued me about this case, at least for me, there were several open questions. This was an SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission enforcement action. But kind of the first question that popped in my mind was, where's the Department of Justice? This would have seemed like something that could have at least been close to a potential criminal charge or a deferred prosecution agreement. Any real thoughts on that one way or the other?
Yeah, it's hard to say. It's all speculation. They have a New York headquarters. The SEC papers talk about the fact that financial transactions went through the banking system. So I think you're right. I think there was evidence that the DOJ could have had jurisdiction here. So it's unclear what happened. DOJ does look at things through different lenses sometimes. There may have been evidentiary issues. And indeed, I think there's a little bit of that maybe in the SEC, because if you notice, the anti-bribery charge only goes to the India stuff. And while there's discussions of potential payments to officials in the Chinese and the Peruvian schemes, those are really only at the end of the day cited as books and records and controls issues. And so it's possible that the DOJ, with its higher standards under the criminal law side, may have looked at what was being provided and decided for whatever reason that they weren't able to meet the evidentiary thresholds that they were going to have to meet as opposed to the SEC, which has lower thresholds that way. It's also possible that knowing the SEC was going to move forward, the DOJ may have decided they wanted to use resources elsewhere. But that's all speculation.
But it is notable that the SEC papers say that they don't say this was a voluntary disclosure, and normally that's one of the big ways to satisfy the DOJ's qualify for declination or along with cooperation or remediation, and that wasn't there. But I think, as John said, they may have been just satisfied with that the SEC got their pound of flesh, and that was sufficient given the jurisdictional hook was not as not that strong for the India issue. So yeah, it's speculation, but normally they're so well coordinated, with very few exceptions, that the fact that there was no DOJ issue release suggests that maybe there won't be one. So it's interesting.
Although we haven't said it yet, YPP was a UK company based in the Isle of Jersey. Mm-hmm. So obviously begs the question, U.S. jurisdiction. However, the SEC was clear that some financial finances went through the U.S. banking system, and more importantly, emails as part of the detailing part of the bribery scheme were kept on U.S. servers. So I don't think in my mind there was a jurisdictional question. But for me, the question was, where on earth was the SFO? Yeah. We have a 250,000 employee UK company with billions in revenue, and as far as I can tell, not a peep from the SFO.
Right.
Any thoughts on that one?
It is surprising, particularly how the U.S. has done and in the U.K. have coordinated on several recent resolutions. I mean, they've done that for years and years, but the last couple, including thinking about Airbus and other ones, they have been very coordinated. So you would have expected, if the SEC was moving forward and the SFO was moving forward, there would have been some coordination and at the same time. So it is unusual. I can't think of a good reason why the SFO wouldn't be interested in this. So your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah, I was going to say resources is the only thing I can come up with. That is that they I know they've been stretched by a number of things, and so it's possible that they may have just said, we're going to let the U.S. folks take care of this, and because we have other fish to fry, as it were. So.
And the last real open question for me was, if there was ever a case to me that seemed to beg for a monitorship, it was this. We had a company with no compliance function up to 2017. We did not have self-disclosure. It was unclear to me how much cooperation there was by YPP, at least early on. And the culture of YPP seemed to me to be one which was not respecting of compliance, nor doing business ethically and in compliance. So as our last speculation, I suppose, any thoughts as to why no monitor? This really even didn't seem to meet the standards to me of the Benchkowski memo.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. I mean the only thing I'll say is that the SEC does talk about a fair amount of remediation that they did in terms of hiring a bunch of people, integrating the networks in a way that appears to have brought them much more centrally under compliance function and much heavier monitoring and so forth. And so, again, speculation would be that what they presented to the SEC as their revamped compliance program, their revamped culture, they did fire a bunch of people, according to the SEC, was enough to justify not getting a monitor. But as you say, there's a lot that they had to overcome. So it'd be interesting to know how much WPP spent on all of their remediation. And it's possible that if they spent a fair amount, that could have helped too. The other thing is systemic. I think there's been, most people will speculate that under the current administration, as now that we've gotten people settled in at both the SEC Division of Enforcement and the criminal division side, that the Benchkowski memo on the DOJ side, and then the similar considerations from the SEC side may start to favor monitors a little bit more than they have the last few years, and that this case is really kind of an interim. It's still in that interim period, so they didn't have the people in place that, that could have maybe made that policy move by the time they got this settled.
Well, gentlemen, I told our audience at the start this is going to be a fun podcast, and I decided I'd judge my podcast by, number one, how much I learned, and number two, how much fun I had. So it was great on both scores. I really want to thank you guys for reaching out. I knew this would be great the minute I heard you wanted to talk about it, and you didn't disappoint. But before we leave, if I could ask if anyone wanted more information on this case or more information about you guys or the firm, where could they go?
Sure, they could go to MillerChevalier.com. We have a newsletter, a quarterly newsletter on all anti-corruption developments focused on FCPA, corporate enforcement action, individual actions, policy developments, and international developments such as SFO resolutions or Brazilian resolutions. And so, in fact, that just came out last week. So that's a great resource. And we did write up the WPP resolution in that last newsletter. So please check it out. Let it email John or me. We add you to our distribution list.
And let me just chime in. That's a great resource. They do a quarterly. They have a year in wrap-up, which is great. But the quarterly reports are equally important for all compliance professionals, white-collar defense lawyers, and anyone else. Gentlemen, I wanted to thank you again. Like I said, it's been a ton of fun, and I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks for having us.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox again. Thank you for listening to this episode of the FCPA Compliance Report. I hope you will check out the latest addition to the Compliance Podcast Network, Hidden Traffic, a podcast hosted by Gwen Hassan. Gwen takes a look at human trafficking and modern slavery in all its forms, but more importantly, what can you as a compliance professional do to help fight this international scourge? Check out Hidden Traffic, newly premiered on the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.